I'm sure it won't have escaped your attention that recently we had the funeral of the great mind Stephen Hawking. And a number of the newspapers commented on his legacy, the extraordinary things he achieved in his lifetime in spite of the physical disabilities he struggled with, and also the outpouring of famous people who wanted to show how impressed they were with him as a man, a number of celebrities at his funeral. But more than one bemused journalist at the fact that Stephen Hawking, an atheist, had two church services for his funerals. And one article in the Times read like this: Stephen Hawking's funeral yesterday, a ceremony first at Great St. Mary's in Cambridge. Now his ashes will be laid to rest next to Newton and Darwin in Westminster Abbey. Just one question. If he was an atheist, why is he being celebrated in not one but two churches? As someone who had 50 years to contemplate the afterlife more closely than anyone, Hawking was clear there wasn't a God. Science offered a more convincing explanation. Great men want glory not only in life but in death. Unfortunately, the only way to achieve this remains quaintly to get into the right church. So even if you spent 50 years denying the existence of God, you're not going to pass up an opportunity of being between Darwin and Newton in favour of someone flinging your ashes off a cliff. But if that isn't having your cake and eating it, I don't know what is. Interesting, isn't it? Hawking himself said these words: Christians have made a human-like being with whom one can have a personal relationship, speaking of God. When you look at the vast size of the universe and how insignificant an accidental human life is in it, that seems almost impossible. For him, the sheer grandeur of the universe, the size of it, and I guess he had a great idea of the scale of the universe, probably more than most of us, the idea that we could have a personal relationship, a bit like another human being relating to us, was impossible. He couldn't conceive of that. And one of the interesting things about this psalm is it engages with exactly that, doesn't it? You have the writer looking at the grandeurs of the universe, the way that God has created his creation, and yet he's involved in every aspect of that creation. And so it goes right to the heart of this question that Hawking was asking: is it possible for a creator God on this sort of scale to relate to human beings in a personal way, in a way that affects all of our lives right down to the minutiae of different decisions that we might have to make? That's what we're going to have a look at today. And we're going to spend some time looking at the extent to which the writer knew God and the extent to which he knew about God. And those two things are quite different, aren't they? I wonder if you've ever met one of your heroes. They say it's always wise not to, don't they? Bit of a disappointment. And one of my heroes when I was a student was a guy called John Stott. Some of you will have heard of him. He was a prolific writer. He died a few years ago. And he was not only an extraordinary guy in terms of writing amazing theological books, had a great brain, but he also had this wonderful social conscience. He wrote a seminal book on dealing with our culture and our community called Issues Facing Christians Today, which a number of you probably have read. It's a little bit out of date now. But at the time, I thought, this guy is extraordinary. And I got a chance to have a cream tea with John Stott. So this was summer in Manchester, 1983, and I was, well, younger. And I was thinking, what's this going to be like, meeting John Stott? And he was amazing. He was witty, engaging, quite extraordinary. He asked more questions of us students, I was a student at the time, than we asked him. He wanted to know what it was like to be our age, because he was in probably his 50s at the time. And he wanted to know stuff about what was going on in our lives as young Christians. And it really made that person three-dimensional for me as a person. Knowing about someone is not the same as actually knowing them. And one of the interesting things about this psalm is that the writer seemed to actually know God. Now, it's tempting to say, well, that's all very well in the Old Testament, isn't it? Because in the Old Testament, there was all sorts of stuff cracking off, wasn't there? Miracles and God intervening and pillars of fire and all those kind of things. And, I mean, you'd be hard-pressed not to know about God because he was so in your face in the Old Testament. But actually, if you do a little bit of a mathematical survey, sorry, a little bit geekish this, head of math speaking, if you do a timeline of miracles and God speaking to people, it's actually very, very revealing. There is a load of stuff going on in Exodus, obviously. You've got all those kind of plagues and you've got God rescuing his people from Egypt. But there's also long periods of time where there doesn't seem to be much happening of a very overt spiritual nature. So if you can imagine doing a little bit of a timeline, David's life is recorded between about 1 Samuel 16 through to 1 Kings 2. And many the commentators attribute this psalm to David. So if we look at his life for a moment to get a sense of what it was like in terms of God revealing himself to people. So you've got quite a lot of the Old Testament talking about David. So you're maybe half of 1 Samuel, all of 2 Samuel, and a little bit of 1 Kings 2. And it might surprise you to know that you don't find many examples at all of supernatural intervention. It doesn't really happen very often. In fact, if you dig around, you find that there's really only 2 examples of God doing something spectacular, and they're actually pretty, you know, on the miracle scale. They're not very exciting. 1 Samuel 5, some trees make a marching sound. And that's a signal for a battle. Okay, not really on the realms of, you know, pillars of fire and parting of seas. And then there's the occasion, the following chapter in 2 Samuel chapter 6, where God strikes down Uzziah when he reaches out to the Ark of the Covenant. And that's pretty much it in terms of David, the biggest writer of the Psalms, and the kind of supernatural events. You can imagine the director of a film about the Bible sitting down with his special effects team and saying something like, "Exodus, guys, amazing. I mean, those frogs, so realistic. And the locusts, oh my word." We're going to do David's life now. You can take a couple of weeks off. We're going to need probably a little bit of work in terms of some trees making marching noises. And then maybe we need, Uzziah, you need to drop down dead as soon as you reach for the Ark of the Covenant. And then, don't worry, Elijah coming soon. All sorts of stuff going on there. The interesting thing about the life of David, who wrote many of the Psalms, is that actually, a lot of the time, he was a faithful guy just doing what he believed God wanted him to do. Even God speaking to David only happens about 5 times in the course of his life that are recorded in the Bible. And I think this is a really, really interesting thing, because one of the fascinating things for me is that there's a negative correlation, almost, between the amount of miraculous that's going on sometimes and the growth of Christian people at the time. So if you look at the Exodus thing, that's probably an example of all sorts of miracles happening. And yet that generation, they all perished in the desert because they just couldn't get it together in terms of faith. And you look at someone like the life of David, who wrote many of these psalms, very little in terms of supernatural intervention. God speaks to him 4 or 5 times in the course of his life directly. Often, God speaks to David, he goes through Nathan, a prophet. He doesn't even get a direct link. And yet, a huge revival for the people of God at that time. So I think it's very interesting, isn't it, that perhaps we're not really hardwired in a way that suggests what we need is the supernatural and all sorts of creation pyrotechnics. What we need is a life where we step out and God is faithful as we act courageously in that situation. So let's have a look at this passage and see how this writer, probably David, is describing God and his knowledge of God. So first of all, he spends some time praising God and goes through a series of instruments. And in many, a number of writers have connected that with the previous psalms. There's speculation as to whether they want a whole psalm together. And he moves on to looking at verse 4 and verse 5. To God's moral attributes. It's interesting that if you'd been around at the time, you would have been painfully aware of the surrounding nations and the fact that they had many, many deities and idols. And those false gods were all sorts of fickle deities. And what the writer is talking about here is the fact that his God is a moral God. A God who is faithful, who is reliable, who keeps his promises, unlike the gods of the nations around. And then he moves on to looking at the grandeurs of the creation. By the word of the Lord, the heavens was made, the starry host by the breath of his mouth. He gathers the waters of the sea into jars. He puts the deep into storehouses. Let all the earth fear the Lord. Let all the people of the world revere him. For he spoke and it came to be. He commanded and it stood still. Extraordinary. David, or the writer, reflects on the universe. And it's a good thing to do, isn't it? I mean, in terms of size, one writer said, if the Milky Way were the size of the entire continent of America, our solar system would fit in a coffee cup. Okay, so there's the solar system. Imagine the size of America. It's kind of the scale is absolutely extraordinary. And David wouldn't have been aware at that time. He would have just looked at the stars and seen creation, been absolutely blown away about it. And I think sometimes in our generation, we find ourselves a little bit on the back foot when it comes to science, don't we? We find ourselves thinking, well, with people, great minds like Hawking saying what they do, perhaps we ought to be a little bit more reticent about whether we are talking about a creator God. Well, I read an interesting survey recently that was done. In fact, it was two surveys that were done a number of years apart. In 1916, there was a random survey taken of 1,000 American scientists. And they were asked whether they believed in a God who answered prayer and in personal immortality. So quite specific questions, not have you got a vague notion of God. They were asked a very specific question about whether they believed in a God who answered prayer and whether they believed in personal immortality. Of those 1,000 people who were asked, these were American scientists, the response rate was 70%. So 70% came back with the question. 42% they said they did believe in a God who answered prayer and in personal immortality. 42% said they didn't, and 16% said they weren't sure. That was 1916. Interestingly, in 1996, the same survey was repeated. This time, 40% agreed that there was a God who answered prayer, and they believed in personal immortality. 45% said no, and 15% were agnostic. Interesting that the best scientific minds in America, still a substantial number of them, go to work every day with a personal faith in God. And it's interesting that there have been a number of very, very eminent scientists who have won various prizes. Francis Collins, the current director of the Human Genome Project, Professor Bill Phillips, winner of the Nobel Prize for Physics in 1997. Sir Brian Heap, who is the former Vice President of the Royal Society. And Sir John Horton, who is co-chair of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, are all eminent Christians in the world of science. So If you are hearing people like Richard Dawkins saying that science has buried faith, it's not true. There are still plenty of scientists who believe, and creation tells us some important things about God. It talks about order. It talks about complexity. This is what the last of those very, very eminent scientists said. Our science is God's science. He holds the responsibility for the whole scientific story. The remarkable consistency and fascinating complexity found in the scientific descriptions of the universe are reflections of the order, consistency, reliability, and complexity of God's activity. So we too can glory in the universe and reflect on the fact that it tells us stuff about God. But then the writer moves on. In verses 10, he talks about the plans of the nations. So he's moved from science to history and politics. The writer would have been aware of a God who rescued his people. How a nation of slaves with no military experience, no heavy weapons, no chariots or cavalry, overcame entrenched positions and routed their enemies. He would have known the story of the children of Israel. But it's interesting, I think, that as the verses move on, it becomes a little bit more real life. So it starts with the strategic, the plans of the nations, but then moves on. Blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord, the people who chose for his inheritance. From heaven, the Lord looks down and sees all mankind. From his dwelling place, he watches all who live on earth. He who forms the hearts of all, whom considers everything they do. No king is saved by the size of his army. No warrior escapes by his great strength. A horse is a vain hope for deliverance. Despite all its strength, it cannot save. But the eyes of the Lord are on those who fear him, on those who hope is in his unfailing love. Seems like this was a guy who not only observed the big picture, but also was aware of what happened in the middle of a battle. All sorts of things can change. If this was David, he would have known what it was like to face down a hardened warrior who was trying to kill him, what it was like to face a cavalry charge. This writer has experienced God's faithfulness. And it's interesting, isn't it, that he's moved from a place where it's a little bit theoretical, where it's maybe a little bit abstract, to a place where this is where the person of God needs to trust their God. And that's vitally important for us as Christians, isn't it? Because none of us want an abstract faith on a Monday morning. I can tell you I don't when I'm facing my year 11s tomorrow. It, probably like you, I'm going to need something that is a little bit more real life than that. I'm going to need something that is about the here and the now. John Owen, who was a monster brain as a Puritan, wrote the following words: if we settle for mere speculations and mental notions about Christ as doctrine, we find no transforming power or efficacy communicated unto us thereby. But when, under the conduct of spiritual light, our affections do cleave unto him with full purpose of heart, our minds fill up with thoughts and delight in him, then virtue would proceed from him to purify us, increase our holiness, strengthen our graces, and to fill us sometimes with joy unspeakable and full of glory. That was one of the leading theological minds of the Puritan era, and he was not satisfied with a head knowledge. For John Owen, it was something that had to be real life. It had to be a matter of the heart as well as the head. And this writer has been in battle, has experienced God saving him, looking after him, being in those situations. And so I want to challenge you to think about this psalm in the context of what you're going to be doing this week. Because many of us will be going into difficult situations, challenging situations, situations where we are going to need a real life faith that is right in the trenches, that is going to be equivalent of taking on the warriors and the horses. We're going to need something that is more than just theoretical. I read recently about a surgeon who used to perform 12, 14-hour operations, hand operations, in the operating theatre. And he was tremendously tired at the end of that, and he was looking for inspiration. He knew that every time he did one of these, it was going to be incredibly tough. And so his father had recently died, and he decided to dedicate it to his father. So when he went in to the operating theatre, he thought about his father, and that inspired him. And he found that this was a really helpful way of thinking. And so he started to ring up his friends and say, I'm going to do this monster surgery. It's going to take 12 to 14 hours. I want to dedicate it to you. I'm going to think about you, and I wonder if you'll pray for me. And it was a way of inspiring him in that situation. And then one day he realized, why don't I do that with God? Why don't I dedicate what I'm doing in the nitty-gritty of my life to him? Why don't I trust that he will give me the strength for that situation? And I found that a tremendously helpful story, because in my life, I'm often going into situations where I'm not sure what's going to happen next, and I'm sure you are as well. Perhaps there'll be relationships that are going to be difficult, conversations that you're kind of dreading, uncertainty about the place of work, about family, about neighbourhood. I guess all of us are going to be thinking about the coming week and wondering what's going to happen next. And we all know that the week never goes out quietly like we've planned, doesn't it? Many's the time we set off on a week and we find at the end of the week all sorts of different things have happened. Life has intervened. And so we need a faith that is going to be real life in the way that this man's faith was. And so he finishes the psalm and says these words: we wait in hope for the Lord. He is our help and our shield. In him our hearts rejoice, for we trust in his holy name. May your unfailing love be with us, Lord, even as we put our hope in you. This is the psalm of somebody who has known God, has experienced their support, their unfailing kindness, and who looks to the future for more of that. We don't know what's going to happen around the corner, do we? There was a man called Benjamin Warfield. Some of you may have heard of him. He was a renowned theologian from the last century. He taught at Princeton Seminary for 34 years. What a lot of people don't know is that in 1876, at the age of 25, he married his sweetheart, Annie Pierce Kincaid, and they had a honeymoon in Germany. In the honeymoon, a fierce storm happened when they were walking, and his wife was struck by lightning and permanently paralyzed. B.B. Warfield spent the next 39 years caring for her until she died. Because of her extraordinary needs, he seldom left his home for more than 2 hours at a time. At the end of her life, he continued for another 6 years, and then he died. And it looks like a shattered dream, doesn't it? You've got this great brain, and he's, at the beginning of his life, going to have to spend all of his life looking after his wife. There's no, on the face of it, happy ending here. But it's still an extraordinary story, because the patience and faithfulness of this one man through 38 years was quite extraordinary. And what's even more surprising is what he said. All that comes from God is under his controlling hand. If he governs all, then nothing but good can befall those to whom he would do good. Though we are too weak to help ourselves and too blind to ask for what we need, and can only groan in unformed longings, he is the author in us of these very longings, and he will so govern all things that we shall reap only good from all that befalls us. He had a remarkable impact through his writings, and clearly had known God very, very personally. Let's bow our heads and pray together. Our Father, we thank you for this wonderful psalm, and we thank you for your loving kindness to us. And we pray for this coming week. We ask that you would guide us, that you would go ahead of us, that you would prepare the way for whatever challenges we meet. And Lord, thank you that you are a God who is not distant, but who is close by, who has a plan for all of us, and one who is working behind the scenes to support when we go out in faith. Amen.